Day from 2 to 3. And up next, we have a Radio Free Thinker.
Hey, I'm Christine. I work in the music department.
Hi, my name is Natalie, the new media coordinator.
Hey, it's Rohit Joseph, sponsorship coordinator.
Hi, this is Yusi, and I'm the outreach coordinator.
This is Brenda, host of Peanut Butter and Jams on Thursdays.
Nasher, the ad coordinator at CITR.
My name is Robin Ellum. I'm the program manager.
Hi, I'm Eric Coates, the student music executive.
This is Costa, the news director.
Hey, it's John, the production coordinator.
Hey, this is Josh. I'm the digital submissions coordinator.
I'm Nellie, host of The Cat's Pajams.
This is Matt Granlin from Stranded, the Australian-Canadian music and talk show.
My name is Hugo. I'm the volunteer manager.
Hey, I'm Jane. I'm the volunteer coordinator.
Hey, it's Sarah Corden-Lee from the CITR music department.
This is Eleanor Waring, president of CITR student executive. From all of us at CITR, we would like to acknowledge and thank everyone who donated to this year's fund drive. With the help of listeners like you, we raised over $38,000. For this incredible generosity, we would like to say thank you.
Thanks, you.
Thank you for donating to Fun Drive.
Thank you very much for your support. We love you guys. Take it easy.
Thank you so much for donating to Fun Drive.
Thank you. Your donation makes such a huge difference.
Thank you so much for all your donations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you all so much for your support.
Thank you very much to everybody that donated for Fun Drive.
Thank you.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you for supporting this year's Fun Drive.
Thanks, guys, for volunteering and donating.
Thank you so much for donating to CITR's Fun Drive this year. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
It's the Web Wisdom Lottery edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, we take a look at some of the best of the web. Dangerous chemicals, how much money, the lottery con, and the winning and losing countries. Let's begin episode 289.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of stars. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week we continue our Web Wisdom series with bits about the world's most dangerous chemicals, how much money is there in the world, the government scam known as a lottery, and which nations are winning and which ones are losers. So let's start off with, how dangerous could a chemical possibly be?
Germany, 1939. In a secret bunker on the German-Polish border, Nazi agents were overseeing the production of a recently discovered chemical they'd codenamed Substance N. It boiled when they exposed it to air, it exploded when it touched water, it was lethal when inhaled, and when it decomposed, it spit out deadly hydrofluoric acid. When loaded into a flamethrower and ignited, it could burn at temperatures over 2,400 degrees Celsius. The plan was to arm troops with Substance N and use it to melt Allied bunkers into hot porridge. But then after studying it for a while, even the German soldiers were like, whoa. Experiments with Substance N were discontinued because the Nazis decided it was too dangerous to work with. Should give you some kind of sense of what we're dealing with here when we talk about the most dangerous chemicals in the world. I'm talking about things that explode when you touch them. Things so poisonous that if even a millionth of a gram went up your nose, it would end up killing you. Things that could even disable you because of their totally debilitatingly horrifying smell. And yes, chemicals so severe that even the Nazis thought they were crazy. Let's start with what the Germans had in that secret weapons bunker. They originally planned to produce 90 tons of the stuff every month, but only made about 30 tons throughout the whole war. What they'd concocted was chlorine trifluoride, the most vigorous fluorinating agent known to humanity. Fluorinating agents rip other molecules apart to replace their hydrogen atoms with fluorine. The result is what chemists call a violently exothermic reaction, in this case known as a fluorine fire. It's much more dangerous to handle than even fluorine gas, which, as any anyone with a degree in chemistry can tell you, is not a sentence that you get to say very often. It's also a better oxidizer than oxygen. Oxidizers are compounds that steal electrons from other chemicals in a reaction, and they are what make combustion possible. Chlorine trifluoride is so good at this that it can burn stuff that sane people might think of as non-flammable, like bricks or asbestos, or things that have already been burned. Oxidizers are also used to ignite rocket fuel, and in the very short time that U.S. rocket scientists thought about using this stuff as a propellant, they quickly learned that this idea was bad. In the early 1950s, the first time that U.S. scientists tried to ship chlorine trifluoride in bulk, the steel tank cracked and a full ton of it spilled out. It burned so hot that the chemical ate through an entire concrete floor, and then a meter of dirt and gravel beneath that. One eyewitness described the spill only by saying, "The concrete was on fire!" Chlorine trifluoride is still manufactured and is used by semiconductor companies to clean their equipment to within an inch of its life. The good news is that you can store it safely in a regular steel drum, as long as it's airtight and you're really, really careful, because it instantly scorches the inside lining of the container, leaving behind a non-reactive plating of metallic fluoride. Non-reactive is not a word that we're going to need when discussing the next chemical on our list, azidoazide azide, the most explosive chemical compound ever created. This twitchy little compound is part of a class of chemicals known as high nitrogen energetic materials, and it does what it does because nitrogen just wants to be left alone. A nitrogen atom bonded with another nitrogen atom is one of the most stable molecules on Earth. Their electrons form an extremely strong triple bond with each other, which in nature can usually only be broken by a molecule being hit by lightning. The strength of that bond means that when two nitrogen atoms snap together, they release a tremendous amount of energy. So if you look at a molecule of AA, we're going to call it AA because azidoazide azide is hard, you can see how it gets its bang. It has 14 nitrogen atoms, and because of the way the molecule is structured, none of them are in a triple bond. Instead, they're stuck in a loosely bound high-energy state and are dying to move to a more stable lower-energy state, which means releasing a lot of pent-up energy in the process. As a result, AA is both highly reactive and heck explosive. How sensitive is this stuff? Well, it's actually hard to say because it's too sensitive even to measure how sensitive it is. A team of German chemists created it in 2010 with the help of the US Army in an effort to develop more energetic compounds. And their first report on the discovery, they said, and I quote, "The sensitivity of C2N14 is beyond our capabilities of measurement. Even the smallest possible loadings in shock and friction tests led to explosive decomposition." To give you a list of how touchy this stuff is, here's a list of things that make azidoazide explode. Moving it, touching it, dispersing it in solution, leaving it undisturbed on a glass plate, exposing it to bright light, exposing it to x-rays, putting it in a spectrometer, turning on the spectrometer, and my favorite, absolutely nothing. They had it in a shockproof explosive case in a dark climate-controlled room, and it blew up. I think somebody said something mean about it somewhere, and it was like, the lead scientists on the team that synthesized it called it a very exciting discovery. If I worked with azidoazide azide, waking up every morning and seeing that I still had all my fingers would be a very exciting discovery. Next up, let's talk about dimethyl cadmium. This is an organometallic compound, which means that it has a molecule in which carbon has bonded with a metal. In this case, that metal is cadmium, a pretty nasty customer all on its own. So far, we've talked about chemicals that explode or cover everything in unquenchable fire. And don't get me wrong, dimethyl cadmium, it does that too. But that is not what makes it so dangerous. It is, in all likelihood, gram for gram, the most toxic chemical in the world. It has both acute and chronic effects, which means that it will kill you now and later. It was first prepared by a pioneer of metal organic chemistry, a fellow named Erich Krauss, who was from, yes, Germany. It was 1917. To give you a sense of how Krauss rolled, he died in his lab at the age of 37 after accidentally inhaling a bunch of chlorine, but before that happened, he managed to report his discovery of dimethyl cadmium. When you breathe it in, it is absorbed instantly into your bloodstream, where it basically serves as a kind of chemical chauffeur for toxic compounds of cadmium to travel all around your body. Because it's so effective at exploding your bloodstream, it quickly affects your most blood-infused organs, like lungs and your kidneys and liver, creating compounds that rip electrons off the atoms of your cells. But if you manage to survive your first few hours after dimethyl cadmium exposure, don't get your hopes up. It's also extremely carcinogenic, so it will take you down with cancer just to spite you. This stuff is so potent that as an airborne vapor, just a few millionths of a gram per cubic meter of air meets the legal safety limits. But if you spill it, How are you gonna clean it up? Water? Well, when it reacts with water, it produces both lots of heat and lots of hydrogen gas, which is flammable, so yeah, it explodes in water. Maybe you could sweep it up? Friction makes it ignite. Might want to just try waiting for it to decompose? Well, it will do that. It'll form a crust of dimethyl cadmium peroxide, which is a friction-sensitive explosive, so you're just one shoe scuff away from kablammo. And on top of it all, the chemical has an odor that's been described as foul, unpleasant, metallic, and disagreeable. But that's nothing compared to our next chemical, thioacetone. It won't explode or start fires or even give you cancer. Compared to other chemicals on the list, it's like a cute little fluffy bunny. If that cute little fluffy bunny had the most ungodly stink you can imagine. That's right, thioacetone takes the prize for the world's smelliest chemical. It's a thiol, an organic compound in which a carbon atom is bonded to a sulfur-hydrogen pair. They're all gross. A skunk spray uses two different thiols to eye-watering effect. Most sulfur-containing compounds are released by rotting meat, which is a reason why we would want to be very good at being able to detect them and also not think that it smells good. But when it comes to bad smells, thioacetone takes the stinky, seriously unappetizing cake. You can smell one drop of the substance almost instantly from half a kilometer away. In the 1960s, a vial of the stuff fell off a shelf in a research lab. People were chucking their cookies in buildings 200 meters away. But the greatest example of thioacetone's silent but deadly strength comes from the German city of Freiburg, where in 1889, chemists at a soap factory were reportedly working on a larger molecule known as trithioacetone, which is used as a flavoring and a fragrance. But when they broke it apart into thioacetone, workers started falling ill. Spontaneous outbreaks of vomiting were reported in the surrounding neighborhoods. It led to the evacuation of the whole city. There might be a lot to learn about thioacetone and thiols in general, but understandably, scientists are not really rushing to look into it. And finally, there's the strongest corrosive agent in the world, the most dangerous acid ever devised by humanity, fluoroantimonic acid. Because what list of dangerous chemicals would be complete without a superacid? What makes an acid is its ability to donate a proton to another molecule nearby it. And a proton is just a hydrogen atom that's lost its electron. This process is called protonation, and an acid's strength is determined by how willing it is to give up that proton. A weak acid, acetic acid, for example, which is just the undiluted form of vinegar, will drag its feet about protonating other molecules. Most of it will just sit there doing nothing. But a strong acid, like sulfuric acid, will punch that proton in the air like a beach volleyball at spring break. And remember from Substance N how crazy fluorine is? Well, fluoroantimonic acid is 10 quadrillion times stronger than sulfuric acid. This molecule is begging for an excuse to fly apart. Once it's lost its hydrogen atoms, the remaining atoms of fluorine and another element, antimony, tear through everything else around them, ripping electrons off nearby molecules and leaving just organic goo in their wake. Especially exciting is that fluorine really likes to bond with calcium, so once the acid tears through the fatty organic tissues of your skin and muscles, the fluorine will burn through your bones. The only way to store fluoroantimonic acid is in Teflon containers. Teflon, by the way, is held together by carbon-fluorine bonds, which are the single strongest bond in organic chemistry. We don't actually know a lot about this acid because it's so hard to do experiments with it. You can't put it in a syringe or on a slide. It eats through glass like it's cotton candy. You can't put it under a fume hood. It'll eat the fume hood. All you can really do is just, like, look at it, ideally from very far away.
And who said chemistry is boring? We'll be right back after this break.
Get ready for the 2015 Metro Vancouver Transportation and Transit Plebiscite. You must be on the provincial voters list to get a vote-by-mail voting package. Register to vote or make sure your voter registration is up to date now at elections.bc.ca/OVR or call 1-800-661-8683. That's 1-800-661-8683. This message is brought to you by Elections BC.
You remember that? And we're back. Do you remember that line in Austin Powers where Dr. Evil was making a ransom demand on the world? Just in case you forgot.
Here's the plan. We get the warhead and we hold the world ransom for $1 million.
Well, don't you think we should maybe ask for more than $1 million? $1 million isn't exactly a lot of money these days. Virtucon alone makes over $9 billion a year.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Slot. Okay, then. We hold the world ransom for $100 billion.
And of course, there was that person who sued for two undecaillion dollars. That's two followed by 33 zeros. 34 if you include the suey himself. Well, that got me thinking, what would be an appropriate ransom? If I were ever, you know, to become an evil scientist. To know that, one would need to know how much money there was in the world. Fortunately, someone has already covered this. And for all my aspiring Dr. Evils out there, let's find out just how much money there is in the world.
On Earth, the average piece of currency changes hands about 55 times a year. That's about once a week. With that kind of turnover, it's safe to say that statistically, in the United States, out of every 100 pieces of currency, one was most likely touched in the last year by someone who, within the next year, will commit murder. But how much cash, how much physical currency is there on Earth? First things first, how much cash is inside a bank? Well, according to the FBI, the average successful bank robbery involves $10,000. But that's usually just currency from the teller's tills. In their vaults, the average bank might have anywhere from $10,000 to $100,000, with some larger banks at times carrying as much as a few million in cash. But what about in our homes? How much loose change do we all have scattered on dressers or lost under cushions? Well, it's tough to accurately figure out the exact number, and many of the estimates vary. Last year, Lloyd's TSB announced that in the UK, the average person has about £14.15 just lying around. A recent survey by Visa looked at a bunch of countries and included cash left at home, the office, and in the car. Their figures are a tad higher, but agree with the U.S. Treasury's estimate a few years ago that the typical U.S. household has $90 to $100 just laying around. Which means that if just everyone in America scrounged up all of their loose change and put it in one place, they would have $15 billion. That's enough to fund 357 more seasons of Arrested Development. But we are asking about how much cash there is on the entire planet. Well, that amount has a special name. It is called M0. It's an aggregate of all coins and banknotes. DollarDays.org's most recent estimate values this total amount, considering all currencies and countries, at just slightly over the equivalent of $5 trillion. That number, the value of all of the currency on Earth, M0, is huge. But believe it or not, it represents less than 10% of all of the money we humans have available to spend right away. To explain, we should look at how money is born. In pretty much every country on Earth, one of the ways new money can be born involves a central bank. Now let's say that in our country, the bank is run by Jake from Vsauce 3. He's really smart and he pays close attention to our economy. If he feels that an increase of the money supply would help us, well, he can just make more money. It's that easy. It doesn't need to be printed as currency to be born. The next step involves the commercial banks, like the Bank of Vsauce. These are the banks that you and I use. All the central bank needs to do is buy some things from these banks using the money it just made, and now the commercial banks have more money. There's another way money can be born. It involves commercial banks and gets to the heart of our question. If I go to the bank and deposit £5, the bank says, fantastic, we will hold on to this money for you, and at any time you want, you can withdraw or spend these £5. The thing is, legally, banks only need to reserve a fraction of the money that they are given. It is known as fractional reserve banking, and it pretty much happens in every country. It means that if someone else comes along, like, say, Kevin from Vsauce 2, and he wants to borrow some money, say, £3, the bank can lend him £3. And now whenever he wants, he can spend these £3. But here's the thing. Kevin can spend £3, and I can spend £5 for a total of £8, despite the fact that there are only £5 in the bank. New money has been born. And if we want to count all of the spendable money on Earth, we are going to need to include this type of money, the kind that fractional reserve banking creates. If we include that kind of money, we are now talking about a number much larger than M0. Economists call this figure M1. M1 includes all physical currencies, as well as money that people can access quickly, like money in checking accounts. Globally, across all countries and all currencies, M1 is estimated to be the equivalent of $25 trillion. M2 is an even broader definition of money, and it includes things that you can't necessarily spend right away. For instance, savings accounts or CDs under $100,000. M2, globally, is currently estimated to be the equivalent of $60 trillion. Finally, M3. This is a broad definition of money that includes all currencies, banknotes and coins, checking accounts, savings accounts, small CDs, and really big long-time deposits. In the American economy, the Federal Reserve doesn't even report this figure anymore, but as a measure of eventually spendable wealth, it's real, and if we consider M3 the global money supply, that gives us a figure that is equivalent to $75 trillion. Of all that money, how much of it is yours? Well, last week, over Twitter, Mark Bodie introduced me to globalrichlist.com. Enter your salary and figure out how you stack up against everyone else on Earth. By the way, you can act just like a central bank and control the money supply yourself. It is illegal, but you can technically increase the money supply by counterfeiting, and you can decrease the money supply by subtracting money. For instance, burning it. If you burn your own money, you become poorer. But because you've decreased the money supply, the power of everyone else's money goes up and they become a tiny, tiny bit richer. Of course, given the amount of money on Earth and the amount that you could probably get your hands on and burn, your effect will be quite imperceptible. One of the largest amounts of cash ever burned was done by KLF, who in the 90s, for reasons no one's still quite sure of, burned £1 million worth of cash. It took them about 2 hours to burn all of that cash, and they recorded the act on video. You could also destroy money by eating it, like the rapper Tyga did, but you probably shouldn't do that either because money is dirty. A study published in Applied and Environmental Microbiology reported that the flu virus can survive on cash for 1 hour to 2 days. And other studies have found that about 7% of cash carries viable strains of dangerous bacteria, like those that cause pneumonia or those that come from feces. That is a lot of germs, and those germs might be high. Studies have found that 92% of banknotes are contaminated with traces of illegal drugs, typically cocaine. In London, that number has been as high as 99%. All it takes is for a few exposed banknotes to circulate normally for all of the cash to become contaminated. Locked within the fibers of a banknote, there's an average of 28 micrograms of cocaine, which means that in 5,000 banknotes, there's enough cocaine for an entire line. These drug traces are nearly impossible to remove from banknotes, so there's little risk of the drugs transferring to your skin. However, they can be detected by drug-sniffing dogs, and on more than one occasion, courts have forced police to return confiscated cash because even though drug dogs detected drugs on the cash, that's just how cash is. As if that wasn't enough, cash is also not nutritious. Termites can eat cash, but to us humans, the ones who love this stuff so much, cash as we know it today, and for that matter, money, doesn't really have any intrinsic value. In a post-apocalyptic world where nothing was stable and survival was a challenge, food, clean water, ammo, weapons, antibiotics, machines, fuel, the trade and exchange and gifting of those types of things would be our economy. When what you use as money has an intrinsic value, it's useful in and of itself, it is known as commodity money. It can also include precious metals, like gold, whose rarity makes it likely to be accepted by other people for goods and services. Now, when you can safely store all of your commodities in one place and you don't need to defend them or lug them around everywhere, representative money often makes more sense. Store your valuables in a trusted place like a bank and get some slips of paper from them saying, yeah, I own that stuff. Now you can walk around with some easy-to-carry slips of paper and use those to buy the things that you want. We are now closer to what we call money today. I say closer because almost all money that we know of today doesn't represent any actual useful commodity anywhere on Earth. This note doesn't represent how much food or water or gold or spices or video games I have stocked up in a bank. It just is money. It's called fiat money. Fiat is Latin for let it be done. And that kind of authoritative command is exactly what gives fiat money its value. The people who make it have decreed that it is valuable. Why? Just let it be done. Because of this, the value of fiat money depends on everyone believing that the people who make it will continue to exist and have the authority that they already do. This means that the value of fiat money, unlike other commodities, can be erased by force. Let's imagine that you live in America and have a lot of dollars. Great job. Well, technically, Canada could invade and declare that the US dollar will no longer be accepted at all. Well, shucks. You now have a bunch of paper, which at best is an incomplete deck of famous American flashcards. The important distinction here is that invading Canadians could technically erase the value of fiat money. But nothing they said or did could make a commodity like gold less valuable. Other countries would still be glad to take your gold and in return give you their own still valuable currencies. No amount of force or authority or laws or rules can make a commodity like potable water any less important to drink or gold any less rare. On the other hand, the value of fiat money depends on our beliefs, what we think. So long as we all believe that fiat money is valuable, it is. This happens all the time. What we believe, what we think we know, can actually cause those things to become true. Actual people, real objects, the way the universe works, and deities like Zeus can exist all by themselves, whether we know about them or believe in them. But some concepts require us to believe in them for them to be real. And if no one believes in them, they literally aren't true. It's called the Tinkerbell effect, and the value of fiat money is an often cited example. But what's really cool is the fact that there are situations where our convictions can actually destroy the very thing we believe in. It's called the reverse Tinkerbell effect, and it describes a situation where as more people believe something, that thing actually becomes less and less true. For example, the idea that driving a car is safe. As more and more people believe this, more people will go out driving, and they are likely to drive less cautiously, ironically making driving less safe. Another example would be the idea that in an election, your vote matters. As more and more people believe this, more people will go out and vote, and the individual weight of each vote will go down. It took hard work and tools to build civilization and find cures and explore our solar system, but we should keep in mind that without doing anything at all, we are still capable of creation. By merely believing in something, we can make it actually, truly...
I believe! Ah, damn. Still only have $20 in my wallet. Maybe I misunderstood. While I go double-check my wallet, you can enjoy this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We're back. So, still not rich. As much as I tried to believe wealth into existence. Well, there's always the lottery. No? Yes, we all know it's a con, yet we still buy our monthly, weekly, daily. How much money do you spend on tickets? Well, it's not all your fault. Let's listen to John Oliver expose, in a hilarious if extremely disturbing way, how our government is acting like some drug pusher, getting you to drop your dollar or ten on the lottery.
The lottery. It's the second best use of magic marker on ping pong balls after Kermit the Frog's eyes. Now, this past week saw a huge Mega Millions draw.
A big winning lottery ticket was sold in New York. Lots of people around here have been peeking at their lottery tickets this morning.
And the Mega Millions mystery this evening, that $321 million jackpot. The search for the winner is on tonight.
Well, the winner shouldn't be too hard to find if someone at your work this week marched in and told everyone to go f*** themselves before flipping their desk over and storming out. That's probably your winner right there. But don't worry if you didn't hit the jackpot. You will frankly have an unbelievable number of other opportunities to play. 44 states currently have lotteries, and you can't have missed the commercials featuring everything from a ping pong ball thunderstorm to a furry dressed as a cat playing with a ball of money to a weird lucky man who for some reason decided to spend his lottery winnings terrifying a penguin by taking it hang gliding. That is a bizarrely specific use of a big lottery win. Look, if my numbers come up, I'm strapping a penguin to my chest and I'm taking to the skies. F*** you, evolution, I decide who flies. That's my choice. My choice. Lottery commercials. Lottery commercials are incredibly seductive, and they're also everywhere. States spend $500 million on them every year, and the reason they do that is that the lottery is a massive moneymaker for them.
Last year alone, lottery sales totaled about $68 billion.
$68 billion. That's more than Americans spent last year on movie tickets, music, porn, the NFL, Major League Baseball, and video games combined. Which means Americans basically spent more on the lottery than they spent on America. And if you think about it, it's a little strange for the government to be running what is basically a gigantic gambling business. But we don't think about lotteries like that, perhaps because they're sold to us more as charitable foundations.
$3 billion for education opens a lot of doors. The Tennessee Lottery. Game-changing, life-changing fun.
Education matters to Oregonians. That's why over $5 billion in lottery dollars have gone to support public education. The Oregon Lottery, it does good things.
Every time you play a New York Lottery game, a portion of your sale goes to aid New York State school children, just like them. New York Lottery, everybody wins.
Thank you for being a friend. Those ads are basically implying that anyone who does not play the lottery is selfish. Hey, why do you want to educate these harmonizing children, you fucking monster? So let's take a look at those slogans. Everybody wins, the lottery does good things, and it's game-changing, life-changing fun. Is it, does it, and do they? Let's start with the basics. The lottery generates $68 billion in sales a year. So where does that money come from?
Over the course of the last two decades, multiple studies have found lower-income households spend a higher percentage of their money on lottery tickets.
Okay, that kind of makes sense. Lots of people like to gamble, and for lower-income households, the lottery is an affordable way to do it. Now, generally, when wealthy people want to take risks with their money, they either choose to invest in the stock market or they leave their wife for Amber without signing a prenup, because Amber's forever. Besides, she just gets you. She's a little tiring, but she'll be there. The lottery is in the business of selling people hope, and they do a great job of that.
Start a college fund for our kids. Start a college fund for their kids. A game with jackpots worthy of your dreams.
Mega Millions. Dream Mega.
That feels like an ad for a mutual fund. But crucially, the lottery is not an investment, because it's worth mentioning that those mega dreams are mega unlikely to happen.
What are the real chances of winning? A lousy 1 in 176 million.
Winning the Mega Millions is akin to getting struck by lightning at the same time you're being eaten by a shark.
Okay. That is both an evocative image and an amazing pitch for a movie. Okay, so there's this guy, he's getting eaten by a shark, see? Lightning hits him, he switches minds with the shark wins the lottery. It's Freaky Friday meets Jaws, I'm calling it Slum Shark Gillionaire. Slum Shark Gillionaire. Channing Tatum has passed. Now, the lottery does have some smaller games and prizes where the odds are a little better, but even then, it pays out a much lower percentage of its revenues than even horse racing. And the worst part is, when you lose the lottery and you're angry with your ticket, you don't even have the satisfaction of knowing that it'll be turned into dog food. And yet, we are still drawn to the lottery, partly because we're told to ignore the odds.
It's your dream. Anything can happen.
Dream, play, win.
Hey, you never know.
Power your dreams for just $2.
Those ads are so effective. In the time it took you to watch that montage, I went out and bought all of these lottery tickets. Someone's gotta win, it might as well be me! But even when people do win big, things have a tendency to go south fast. We've all seen tragic headlines about lottery winners like a lottery winner blows through 27 million, lottery winner found dead in bed, or brother hired hitman over 16 million jackpot win. It seems winning the lottery can be like marrying Tom Cruise. Sure, it seems amazing in your mind. You might even dream about it happening one day. But if it actually does, 5 years later, the magic will be over, you'll be estranged from your family, and you will have seen things you can never unsee. Never. In Israel, lottery winners are actually photographed wearing masks to protect their identities. And in the 90s, this is how one man from Gaza collected his prize.
Most lottery winners don't turn up with a bag over their head, but this 24-year-old Palestinian wanted to remain anonymous.
That's right. Winning the lottery is such a curse that you can find yourself in the Middle East with a bag over your head because something good happened to you. So why do people play? Well, for some, they can't stop. The lottery can be extremely addictive, and states know this. Many lotteries offer resources to help problem gamblers. The Illinois Lottery even has a section on their website for responsible gaming. Although when we clicked on the link, we got, and this is true, a pop-up ad for the lotto. Seriously, Illinois? There is a reason that the first step in a 12-step program isn't congratulations on starting the program. Why not reward yourself with a refreshing gin and tonic? Cheers. But look, I'm sure that is just an innocent mistake, just like I'm sure that it's a coincidence that if you Google lottery intervention, this is what comes up.
Need a lottery intervention? Play the new DC Fast Play games from the DC Lottery. Feel the thrill of winning instantly.
Are you kidding me? Someone at the DC Lottery deserves a promotion before they go directly to hell. And at the very same time they're supposedly addressing problem gambling, states are actively expanding into even more addictive products. Just look at Oregon.
The lottery takes in about $1 billion every 2 years for the state. About 80% of it, maybe even more, 86, 90%.
Yeah, that's what we're running right there on the screen. Boy.
Comes from one source, and that's these video machines, mostly video slot machines or video poker.
The vast majority of Oregon's lottery income comes from video slots and video poker, meaning that Oregon claims this is a lottery machine. Because of course it is, just like this is a lottery wheel, and this is a lottery table. And of course, we all remember Martin Scorsese's movie, Lottery. Machines like these are not only addictive, they're incredibly lucrative. Internal Oregon lottery data indicates that regular lottery players lost an average of $106 per year, whereas video poker and slots players lost an average of $2,564. That's an insane amount of money. You could buy a 98 Mazda with that money, and you should. You should. It's got a moonroof and six-way speakers. You should get in it right now and drive in the opposite direction of any video poker machine. Although, good luck with that if you live in Oregon, because these machines are everywhere. There are more than 12,000 of them in the state. And that kind of ubiquity puts some people in serious danger.
My boyfriend and I have gotten into fights over, you know, I'll go out, you know, I'm just going somewhere with a friend of mine and I end up playing video poker and where I'm supposed to go to the store to buy food and I come home with no food and no money, you know, as soon as I walk in the door, he knows. And then we don't have any food.
Remember, the machines that are causing her such trouble are run by the state. A state which proclaims its lottery does good things. And at this point, I'm thinking it may not be a coincidence that the logo for the Oregon State Lottery is someone crossing their fingers, the universal sign for lying. Okay, so maybe the next question... Maybe the next question should be this. Why do state lawmakers keep approving all this? Well, as those singing children told us, lotteries are really all about good causes like education, and that's always been the excuse. State lotteries were illegal in this country until 1964, when New Hampshire launched the first one under the guise of a very familiar message.
How come you're buying one of these tickets?
This is the first one in our country, and I would like to participate in it. And I also feel that it's for a very good cause of education.
I don't think there's a better reason for buying one of these.
Well, there probably isn't a better reason, but there are plenty of better ways to fund education. Sales tax, bake sale, or simply putting cash into an envelope, writing school on the front of it, and mailing it. Because for all the claims that lotteries are a huge boost to education, the reality is a little different.
Our investigation of government spending in the 24 states that dedicate lottery funds for education yields a stunningly bad report card. The percentage of state spending on education is down or flat in 21 of those states from coast to coast.
Lotteries provided no additional funding for education in 21 out of 24 states. As math students in one of those places would put it, that is nearly 50%. How is this possible? Well, look, let's just look at North Carolina. Their governor inaugurated the North Carolina Education Lottery nearly a decade ago with big promises.
When the lottery is fully implemented, we'll be adding another $500 million annually for education.
$500 million extra? That sounds great. You'd think by now all North Carolina preschoolers would be strutting around in fine bespoke suits, quoting Nietzsche and Kierkegaard. But in fact, North Carolina currently spends less per student on education than it did when the lottery even began. And if you're thinking, how the fuck is that possible? It's because money in state budgets tends to move around a lot. Trying to add money just for one purpose is a bit like trying to piss in one corner of a swimming pool. It's going all over the place, no matter what you claim. And let me give you just a narrow example. In 2012, North Carolina used $100 million of lottery money for school construction, but that didn't mean the school construction budget was $100 million bigger than it would have been, because while that money was flowing in, other money was flowing out.
A portion of corporate income taxes used to go toward construction, but when the lottery passed, that tax money went away, substituted with lottery revenue.
And where did that corporate tax money go? Who knows? There's not even a warm spot where it once was. But in a completely unconnected development, North Carolina plans to cut corporate taxes substantially over the next few years. So thanks for playing the education lottery, North Carolina. Better luck next time. But despite all this, states are not only keeping faith in lotteries, they're doubling down and trying to reach new players by putting it on your cell phone. Illinois launched an app this year to let you buy tickets on your phone, which is terrifying. Because we all know that if, starting right now, your mother could play the lottery as easily as she plays Candy Crush, in 3 weeks she'd be preparing Thanksgiving dinner over a trash can fire. But I'm sure that Illinois will make the same argument that everyone does to justify state-sponsored gambling. Hey, it brings in money for good causes. Except, as I think we've seen by now, lotteries are bad for losers, often bad for winners, and a pretty compromising way to assist state budgets. Think about it this way. Gambling is a little like alcohol. Most people like it, some are addicted to it, and it's not like the state can or should outlaw it altogether. But it would be a little strange if the state was in the liquor business, advertising it by claiming that every shot of vodka you drink helps school children learn. Yeah. Thank me for being a friend. I'm gonna get those kids an iPad. I'm a winner. Everybody's a winner.
Okay, after that, I think I need a drink. Here you go, kids. While I drop one back, you can enjoy this break.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
But by leaving out the most important things you need to know, they can elevate awareness to a new all-time low.
I own my media.
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 The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members.
But if it's just left out, can you say the paper lied? A lot of things that happened didn't happen after all. If there's no one in the forest who will put it in the news, I guess the tree didn't fall.
Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
I'm joining today. You should too.
And we're back. Speaking of winning or losing the lottery, let's listen to how some nations score on a winning or losing scale.
I'm going to be looking at countries. We'll look at the different categories of country rankings and which countries are at the top and bottom of those lists. The first category we're going to look at is size. The largest country in the world is Russia. Obviously. Okay, so no surprises there. I'm sure we all know that Russia is the biggest country in the world. But do you know just how big Russia is? About 17 million square kilometers. Okay, but those are just a bunch of meaningless numbers, especially if you're not familiar with the metric system. But here's a few things about Russia that might help give you some perspective. Russia borders more countries than any other, sharing land borders with 14 different countries. Norway, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Belarus, Ukraine, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, China, and North Korea. Well, that's 12 of the countries it borders, but it also has two more borders because its most western point, the Kaliningrad Oblast, which is separated from the mainland, gives Russia two more land borders, Lithuania and Poland. Although if we take a closer look at Georgia, a country that has two de facto independent countries within it, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which have both declared their independence from Georgia, these self-declared independent countries have very little international recognition, but one country that does recognise both of them is Russia. So according to Russia, at least, they border 16 countries. And let's not forget they also have extremely close maritime borders with the United States and Japan. Russia really is in a league of its own compared to other countries, with second place Canada only 58% the size of Russia. Russia is more compatible in size with the continents of the world. Russia is bigger than three of the seven continents and only slightly smaller than South America. Also, Russia comprises 11% of the Earth's land area, and in terms of surface area, Russia is bigger than Pluto. Russia also has 9 different time zones, although it could be 10 because GMT plus 5 is skipped. Okay, I'm sure you get it now. Russia is big. And as mentioned, Canada is in second place. In third place is... well, it's disputed. It's either China or the United States. Which country is in third place is dependent on two factors, China's disputed territories and the water area of the United States. China has several disputed territories, including disputes with India, Bhutan, Vietnam, Japan and North Korea, as well as claims to the Spratly Islands, the most disputed territory in the world, claimed by six different countries. Of course, the easy solution is just to count none of these when calculating China's area, which is exactly what most sources do. The real issue is how the water area of the United States is calculated. Water area of a country should only include inland waters, but both the UN and the CIA World Factbook are biased towards the USA by counting coastal or territorial water for the US but not for other countries. Coastal water is defined as 3 nautical miles from the coast and territorial water is 12 nautical miles. Territorial water can seriously exaggerate a country's area. Take this hypothetical perfectly round island, which is 1 square kilometre in area. Now if we include territorial water in its area, and by using a little bit of maths, we can calculate that the area of this island would now be over 1600 square kilometres. The Philippines is a great example of why territorial waters are not counted. However, both the UN and CIA are guilty of being inconsistent by counting coastal or territorial waters for the US but not for other countries. Take a look at the state of Hawaii, which is about 40% water by area. Now with a state this small it's not so bad, but with a state like Alaska, territorial water make an already massive state even bigger. Realistically, there is no dispute, China is bigger, but several sources list the United States as the third largest country in the world. But to completely remove the issue of water area, we could look at just land area. Counting only land, China is unambiguously bigger than the US, and all sources agree on that. However, if we're just counting land, then Canada drops all the way to 4th place behind the US. This is because Canada is about 9% water by area with an estimated 3 million lakes, which make up 60% of all the lakes in the world. Looking at the opposite end of the spectrum, the three smallest countries in the world are Nauru, Monaco, and of course, Vatican City. And since the Vatican is where the Pope lives and is about half a square kilometre in size, statistically the country has 2 popes per square kilometre. Comparing the largest and smallest countries, Russia is about 38 million times the size of Vatican City. Moving on to population now, and once again the winner of this category is pretty obvious. It's China. Second is India and third is the United States. And while this podium shows their correct places, it doesn't really show the full story. A more accurate podium might look a little something like this. This is because second place India is nearly 4 times as populous as the USA. Together, China and India make up about 37% of the world's population, and it only takes the top 6 countries to make up half the population of the entire world. Now looking at that podium again, it would be easy to assume that India and China's populations are similar. And proportionally, maybe they are. China's population is only about 9% more than India's. In terms of sheer numbers though, not at all. The difference is huge, about 118 million, which is the same as the population of Mexico, the 11th most populous country in the world. Or if you prefer US states as a unit of measurement, that's 4.5 times the population of Texas or 3 Californias, or 205 Wyomings. Or to further emphasise the population gap, the difference is about the same as the combined total of Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Mexico City, Rio de Janeiro, Buenos Aires, London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, Cairo, Johannesburg, Moscow, Istanbul, Jakarta, Tokyo and Sydney. In last place is Tuvalu, Nauru and once again the Vatican City. Once again, if we compare top and bottom of the list, China has about 1.7 million times as many people as the Vatican. But what's more amazing is if we look at the population growth of China, China's population grows by the population of Vatican City every single hour, with their population increasing by more than 19,000 every day. Although India's population is growing much quicker, at about 42,000 people per day, that's 29 every minute, or about 15.5 million per year, which is the same as the population of Ecuador. India is set to overtake China as the most populous country in the world by 2025, and is set to break the 1.5 billion mark by 2033. Next we move on to population density. Population density is basically just how many people on average live per square kilometre, and is simply population divided by area. Unsurprisingly, the three city-states of the world are at the top of the list. However, if we include the special administrative regions of China, both of them make the top five. Although not sovereign states, they're basically treated as separate countries and their population and area are never counted within China's figures. Macau is so densely populated that if the population of the whole world lived as densely as Macau, all 7.1 billion of us could live within the country of Germany. And if every country in the world were as densely populated as Macau, the population of the world would be nearly 3 trillion. Of course, these countries are only so densely populated because they're so small. If we use an arbitrary cutoff and only include countries over 100,000 square kilometers, Bangladesh is the most densely populated. The least densely populated country in the world is Mongolia. However, if we include constituent countries, then it's Greenland, with a population density of 0.026, meaning that there's enough room in Greenland for every person in the country to have 38 square kilometers to themselves. If the whole world lived as sparsely populated as Greenland, the population of the world would only be 3.8 million. That's about the same as the population of Los Angeles. If we spot the population densities of Macau and Greenland, Greenland's population would be over 43 billion, while Macau's population would be zero. Now we move on to something a little bit different, homicide rate. Now there's two ways to rank the countries, by rate and by count. Rate is the number per 100,000 people, while count is just the raw number itself, not taking into consideration how populated the country is. Ranking by rate gives the most accurate picture. The top two are the two bordering countries from Central America, Honduras and El Salvador, and in third place is Ivory Coast. If the world had a homicide rate of Honduras, there would be over 6.5 million homicides every year. That's 17,900 a day, or one every 5 seconds. Now if we rank the countries in terms of just the number of homicides, in which obviously the more populous countries have a disadvantage. The top three are India, Brazil and Mexico. And while India and Brazil both have around 43,000 homicides per year, this is actually a relatively low rate for India, lower than the US actually, while Brazil's rate is very high since India is 6 times as populous as Brazil, yet only has 138 more homicides. Of course, this is one list in which being at the bottom of the list is best. Two countries are the clear winners of this category with absolutely no murders in the year of the study, and those are Monaco and Palau. But then again, it would be pretty hard to get away with murdering someone in Monaco given that there's on average 18,000 people per square kilometre. If we use another arbitrary cutoff and only include the 50 most populous countries in the world, the countries that come out on top are Japan, Spain and Germany. And while on the subject of death, let's look at suicide rates. The three countries with the highest suicide rates are Greenland, Lithuania and South Korea. Interestingly, suicide is far more prevalent among males across all countries and cultures. One country that's worth mentioning is Japan, with a fairly high suicide rate of 21.7. Combine this with an extremely low homicide rate of 0.3 means that statistically Japanese people are 72 times more likely to kill themselves than be killed by someone else. Okay, that's enough about death now. On to age. The youngest country in the world is South Sudan, which declared its independence from Sudan in 2011. Sudan used to be the largest country in Africa until then, but dropped to third place, with Algeria now the largest country on the continent. Interestingly, the second, third and fourth newest countries in the world all used to be part of the same country. In the early 90s, Yugoslavia split into five different countries: Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbia and Montenegro, and Macedonia. Serbia and Montenegro then split into two separate countries called, well, Serbia and Montenegro. Although technically it was the other way around, Montenegro declared its independence. Then in 2008, Kosovo declared its independence from Serbia. Although it's worth mentioning that Kosovo isn't a member of the UN but is recognised by the majority of its members. The oldest countries in the world are significantly more difficult, if not impossible, because of the different definitions of the word country. While countries like Egypt and Iran may be good candidates to call the oldest countries, having been around for more than 5,000 years, although they bear little or no resemblance to their modern day counterparts. If we use just the date at which the country in its current form was founded, then the oldest countries are Japan, China and San Marino. Although even that's debatable, as it's such a complex issue that it could easily be a video in itself. And finally, we move on to minimum wage. Top of the list are Luxembourg, Australia and Monaco. But these are just nominal values, they don't show any real value. Cost of living varies significantly by country, so money isn't worth the same in every country. To get a clearer picture, a hypothetical currency, the international dollar, was invented, which uses the United States as a comparison and takes cost of living into consideration. Therefore, countries like Mexico and Poland, which have lower cost of living, money is worth more, but in countries such as Norway and Switzerland, money isn't worth as much. For example, the federal minimum wage in the United States is $7.25, which is worth $7.25 in America, but it's worth different amounts in different countries. Of course, that's just the federal minimum wage and the average cost of living. For example, San Francisco has a minimum wage of $10.74 because it's the most expensive city in the country.